Hey, good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Neil Yerche Kala kickoff. Great to have everyone virtually. Wish we could do it in person, but between COVID and the snow, I think we're all probably glad that it's happening online. Just before we start, I just wanted to thank Jenny Nadoff, who we see on the Zoom, for sponsoring the show this morning in memory of Gedalia Reuven Levy, Ben Yerachmiel David's yard site. Before we begin the shiur, if you could just either in the chat or raise of hands or whatever, indicate, do people have the source sheets in the folders, or is it better if I share a screen? I'm happy doing either way. I went over to Bond earlier to get a folder and, more importantly, to get the free latte for my wife. And there was a big, great, we'll share the screen. There was a big, big stack of folders that was sitting in Bond. So we'll share. That's great. Okay, so topic this morning, we're trying to think of a broader subject, and as we begin Sefer Shemos and really get into the Chumash there, I thought a great topic we could do for 40 minutes or so would be to introduce some of the methodology of the Ramban, who's really one of the pillars of our whole world of Parshanut and our whole world of Hashkafa. When people talk to me and ask how they should, people want to start teaching Tanakh, or how would you give a Tanakh shiur or something? How would you learn a methodology? The yeshivas in Israel and America, so there's a lot of emphasis on how to learn a sugya in Gemara, but there's not nearly as much on how to learn what we would call, a piece of Tanakh. And I just tell people the best thing to do is learn Ramban. Learn Ramban. The Hebrew with the art scroll. The art scroll did an amazing job a few years ago. Learning Ramban, because he has methodology which is so, so helpful for how we approach Tanakh from the Pasuk level, from the broader, 30,000 foot level, getting ourselves into the shoes of the personalities in the Tanakh and really getting to understand from a human perspective what they're going through. And so what we're going to do this morning is we're going to look at a few Rambans from the beginning of Shemos and Va'era as like case studies to show examples of some of the methodological themes of the Ramban. Okay, so let's start. Load up the screen here now. So this one have it. It's actually better to do, I see they printed these out in black and white, which is mostly good. And I'm totally spoiled by Zoom shiurim, because in days before Zoom, there was no such thing as color. Mara Makomos, never know it's spending that money on the ink. But now on Zoom, you can know it so easily. And that's great, because this map I have over here was much more clear in color than it is in black and white. So the reason why I put these maps in the beginning is because I want to get a sense of where the Ramban is coming from. The Ramban is born in the city of Gerona, which is right over here. And you can see it is in the northeastern tip of Spain. Normally, people think of the Ramban as a Sephardi. All Sephardim are the same. At least that's how Ashkenazim like to think. And so the Ramban is a Sephardi. And you think we have the Ashkenazim on one side. We have the world of Rashi on one hand. And that's the world of, Midrash. And then we have the world of Spain on the other side. And that's the world of Ibn Ezra. That's the world of Abarbanel. That's the world of Shap. That's the world of Sfarad. And we think of the Ramban. Okay, the Ramban is from Sfarad, so that's probably the camp he's in. But you take one look at the map, and then we'll look at the history. We'll see very clearly part of what makes the Ramban so unique is that he is born in an area. I'm going to try to get right to mute if possible. The Ramban is born in an area which is smack in between France and Spain. Gerona's all the way up here. And if you take a look, the Ramban is born in, I think, 1194. So this is the political situation at 1200. So you have the county of Barcelona. Gerona is right over here. And look, this is Barcelona. This is Spain. Perpignan, right over here. This city, this is a city from modern southern France. The Meiri, who's, Rishon in the early 1300s, from Provence, who's normally thought of as someone from France, is living in the same political kingdom, right? The county of Barcelona, which has just been annexed by the kingdom of Aragon. This is all one political unit. The great Jewish center. Can I mute people? That's
where I can. Okay, easy. Sit.
The great centers of southern France, Montpellier, Narbonne, Perpignan, they're all right next to where the Ramban is living right over here. He is smack in between. He gets the combination of France and Spain. Happens to be the Ramban's teachers learned in the yeshivas of southern France. The Baalei HaTosfot, right, who are all descendants or students of the descendants of Rashi, are the teachers of Ramban. So Ramban, in all his works, has an amazing blend. He's getting the world of Ashkenaz, which is right next door, and it's from his teachers. He's getting the world of Sfarad from also his neighbors, many of whom also have moved to this area after the Almohads conquer Spain, or Muslim Spain, in the mid-1100s. So you have someone who is sitting between two worlds. He has Rashi, he has the Ibn Ezra. He writes extensively on the Rif and the Rambam from the world of Sfarad, and yet his Chidushim on the Shas are written just like the Chidushim of the Baalei HaTosfot. And that blend between the two worlds of Ashkenaz and Sfarad is really exemplified in his commentary as well. And he is coming 100 years or so after Rashi and a generation after Ibn Ezra. So you have the two titans in the Mefarshim of Medrash and of Pshat. You're also coming after, between the two of them, they have carefully explained the words of the Chumash. And so the Ramban, when he begins his Perush Al HaTorah, he's put in a position where he can draw on the methodology of both of them, build on both of them, and he can also go into directions where the two of them have not yet gone. Just like in the world of Gemara, you first needed Rashi before you could have Tosfot. You first needed to actually understand the line by line of the Gemara before you could take a step back and contrast one Gemara in Kiddushin with one Gemara in Sanhedrin, which is what the Baalei HaTosfot do. Well, the same exact thing is true for the Ramban. Once you have Rashi and Ibn Ezra going through every single pasuk and explaining the words, the Ramban now has really the luxury of being able to take a step back and look at broader themes. So there are five methodological themes that I want to highlight, and we'll see how many of them we're able to get through in some of the case studies that I put in the Marmol Kol Hashiva. Those are, number one, the big picture. Ramban, this 50,000 foot view, he's able to take sweeping looks at a perek, at a parsha, and as we'll see in a couple of minutes, even entire Sfarim of the Chamisha Chumshei Torah. Number two, and what's amazing is that he puts number two together with number one, is that while the Ramban is a big picture thinker, he also has incredible sensitivity to detail. Just like when learning Rashi, we can have a Rashi. And when you learn Rashi, as we know, we always have to ask, what's bothering Rashi? And often it's one word which is out of place, which Rashi picks up on and then builds on that to a massive idea. The Ramban has that exact same sensitivity to the granular detail, even as he's also focusing on the big picture. And then the three other themes to think about for this morning. Number one, the complexity of thought, Ramban's being open to multiple options, the level of Pshat and the level of Drash, the reading of Chazal and the reading of Rashi and the reading of Ibn Ezra, those can all be put together simultaneously. The Ramban will often say, Yitachin this way, this option makes sense, and this option also makes sense. They do not need to be mutually exclusive. There are multiple Torah truths and multiple ways to read a Parsha, and the Ramban will give them to you. Number four, he's just incredible erudition. The Ramban, he knew everything. He knew everything by heart. That's really clear now with some of the more redone versions of the Ramban's writings, where they footnote, references he has to different psukim or something in his writings. And you see, even just in his writing style, he's just off the top of his head quoting from psukim all the time. He has Tanakh at his fingertips. He has Medrash at his fingertips. Halacha, Gemara, all the writings of the Rambam. He just has everything, and he can deploy it when he wants to prove a point. He can just deploy it in a way which is absolutely incredible. And the last major theme, and one which really is one of the reasons which makes his Perush on Chumash so fundamental, is the human insight and sensitivity, the psychological insight, the ability he has to get us into the shoes of the personalities in the Chumash, reconstruct events, and from that perspective explain what the people there are doing and what we are supposed to learn from those parts of the Chumash. Okay, so let's take a look. So I put five Rambans in there. Six. Okay, so same as we got. So the first one is the Ramban's introduction to Shemot. Now, let's make it a little bigger. The fact that setting in and of itself, the Ramban writes an introduction tells us something about the commentary, right? Rashi does not have an introduction to the Chumash. Rashi doesn't have an introduction to Sefer Bereishis, because Rashi is not thinking in terms of sweeping themes which require an introduction. Here's what you should be thinking as you begin the Sefer of Shemot. But the Ramban, not only does he write an introduction to his parish on the Chumash, he writes an introduction to every single one of the Chamisha Chumshe Torah, because the Ramban has a core assumption that there's a reason why the Ribbono Shel Olam divided up the Torah into five Chumashim. He assumes each of the Chumashim has a theme. And we're going to read a couple of these sentences inside. We're going to see how much work the Ramban can pack into just a few psukim at the beginning of his introduction. Let's just take a look at it and we'll see what's going on. Ramban says, the beginning of his introduction to Sefer Shemot, Hishlim HaKasav Sefer Bereishis, Shehu Sefer HaYetzirah. So Torah has now completed the book of Bereishis, which is the book of creation. Now, we may have heard of the name Sefer Yetzirah, but the Ramban in those few words has just made a massive assumption, which is, I can define what Sefer Bereishis is all about, right? There is a uniting theme to the whole book. Now, what does that mean that it's Sefer Yetzirah? Just one second. I'm just going to try to expand this to figure out where the noise is coming from, so I can mute whatever it's coming from. Just one second. Okay, I think we're covered. So, right, so sorry. One second. It's big. There we go. Okay. All right, so the book of Bereishis is the Sefer Yetzir v'Chidush HaOlam. Now, what does it mean that the book of Bereishis is the book of creation? Well, you could say it's the book of the world is created, but does the world being created, does that really define Sefer Bereishis? I mean, that happens in the first parak, maybe the first couple of brakim. We got 48 to go. Most of Bereishis, obviously, talks about the stories of the Avos and the Imaos and the Shvatim. So what does it mean that the book of is the book of creation? So the Ramban explains, well, it's the book of creation of the world, Chidush HaOlam. And then here's the key line. Uv mikrei havot, the stories of the forefathers, shehim ki'inyan yitzira, those are also a form of creation, lizaram, for their descendants, mibnei shakol mikreihem tziurei devarim lermoz uladia kol ased lavo lahem. The stories of the Avos are a form of creation because those are all hints to what is going to occur in the future to their descendants. What the Ramban has done in one sentence, he has taken the idea, and it's his idea. We've all heard of it. Masa avo simen labanim. What happens to the forefathers is a symbol for what is going to happen to the descendants. And not only is that just the Ramban's idea, but he says that explains the theme of Sefer Bereishis. All the stories of the Avos and the Imaos and the Shvatim are creating the DNA, the spiritual DNA for Bnei Yisrael. It's amazing. With modern science, we can have like an analogy to understand the theological idea that the Ramban was getting at. And the DNA for Bnei Yisrael is being laid in by the stories that happen to all of the Avos and Imahos and the Shvatim. So just one example. At the very end, the Ramban has an essay at the beginning of Parshas Vayechi where he shows how the exile of the Yaakov and the Shvatim to Egypt at the end of Sefer Bereishis is laying the DNA for the eventual exile of Bnei Yisrael to Rome. the exile of Rome. He shows the parallels between how Rome was initially invited into Israel and how they got in because we tried to develop an alliance with Pompey, and that did not work very well. And ultimately, that leads to total enslavement and long, long years of exile and oppression. And the Ramban says that that DNA is being laid in by what's happening at the end of Sefer Bereishis. So that's just one sentence in the Ramban, the assumption that there is a unifying theme to Sefer Bereishis. That theme is creation. And Masa Avosim Labanim, you have the creation of the universe and then the creation of the destiny of Bnei Yisrael. Okay, well then what is the unifying theme to Sefer Shmos? So says the Ramban, read two more sentences. Ya'achare Shehishlam Hayatzira, once we finish the creation in Bereishis, Hischil Sefer Acher, Be'inyin HaMaaseh HaBamin HaRimazim HaHim. We begin the next book with the actual activities which come out of those hints. The DNA that was laid in Sefer Bereishis now is going to be expressed beginning with Sefer Shemos. Now, okay, so, but why, what is unique about Sefer Shemos? I mean, the story, Shemos could have ended anytime. The truth is, if we stop and think about it, we so take for granted that we have a Sefer Shemos, but if we had to end the book of Shemos, let's remember, we have Yetzias Mitzrayim, the giving of the Torah, then all those parshios at the Mishkan where we begin to space out towards the end, we have the golden calf, where should Shemos have ended? Well, we could have ended Shemos at Kriyas Yamsuf, right? We're enslaved by Egypt, we leave Egypt, end of the book. It would have been a logical place to end. We could have ended Sefer Shemos with the giving of the Torah, right? You go from Pesach to Shavuos, end there. That would have been reasonable. We also could have ended Sefer Shemos in the middle of Vayikra, because the last few parshios of Shemos describe the building of the Mishkan, but then we don't actually read about the dedication of the Mishkan until Parsha Shmini. Sefer Shemos ends on a very bizarre cliffhanger. They build the Mishkan. Moshe is not able to get inside. Moshe is stuck outside of the tent. Then, boom, the book ends with Moshe locked out of the Mishkan. And then you open up Sefer Vayikra, and the first pasuk of Vayikra says Hashem calls out to Moshe, and Moshe now is allowed inside the Mishkan. And then they actually dedicate it in Parsha Shmini. The Sefer ends in a very, very strange place. Not only that, but it begins in a strange place, because how does Sefer Shemos begin? With the names, right? Ela Shemos, Bnei Yisrael. Here are the names of the Jews who came down to Egypt, which is repetitive because we know who they are. The Torah in by Vayigash told us who came. So once you're assuming, and this is the Ramban's assumption, that there is a unifying theme to the book of Shemos, and you need to explain it, well, now we need to explain why does it begin where it begins? Why does it end where it ends? And the Ramban does exactly that. What does he say? And from what he says, we're going to come out with a fundamental perspective, and this really revolutionizes the way we think about what redemption means. What does Yetzias Mitzrayim mean? What does Geula mean? Take a look. Ramban says, okay, fine. Nisyachid Sefer Eila Shemos. What singles out the book of Shemos? The book is all about the first exile, which we were, which was decreed upon us, and the redemption from. So that's the Ramban's claim. The book of Shemos is the book of exile and redemption. And then the Ramban is going to explain. So he says, why does the book begin by repeating the names of the Shvatim, which you already know? This is very simple. Since this book is the book of exile and redemption, we need to begin the book with the exile. Now, the exile was already told at the end of Bereishis. We know why that is true. We needed to learn about that exile in Bereishis because that is part of the DNA of Bnei Yisrael, is exile. When we want to know how what exile looks like, you know, we nowadays have to go back to the origins. Exile needs to be in Bereishis. But it also needs to be in Shemos because it's the book of exile and redemption. So he says, "Lachin chazar v'eschil b'Shemos yordei Mitzrayim." That's why we got to go back and repeat because that is the theme of the book, exile and redemption. Now, okay, now here's the breakthrough point for the Ramban, and this is another major theme of his. If this is supposed to be the book of exile and redemption, then it should have ended with Kriyas Yamsuf, when they leave Egypt. Or it should have ended with the giving of the Torah, because we've heard the Divrei Torah. The reason why we have Sfiras HaOmer is because we're not just free people. True freedom is receiving the Torah, and that's our ultimate destiny. So maybe we weren't actually redeemed until the giving of the Torah. So okay, so Torah the Shemot should end at Parashas Yisro. Why does it keep going? So the Ramban explains. He says, well, you need to understand what redemption means. Redemption doesn't just mean that you're out of Egypt and you're out of slavery. Redemption means you have erased everything that was that you suffered during exile. He says, "Hinei hagalut eino nishlam." Right, the exile is not completed. Ad yom shuvam el mekomam, until they go back to their previous place, vel malat avatam yashuvu, and they return to the level of their forefathers. Now, then we might wonder, well, wait a second. If the exile is not over until they get back to where they came from, well, maybe Sefer Shemot should not end until the end of the Chumash. Maybe the exile does not end until they get back to Israel. So Ramban's going to explain. No, you need to stop thinking physically. We're not talking about physical exile, getting back to the physical location where they were. When we think of exile, we need to think spiritually. And he says, "Kishiyatzi mimitzrayim, we left Egypt. Afa pishiyatzi veisavadim, we left the house of slavery. But adayin yechashu golim, we left slavery, but we still were considered exiles. Ki lo yu ba'aretz lo ki yu ba'aretz lo lahem nevuchim ba'medbar, we're wandering in a desert, land doesn't belong to us, but." We got to the mountain. We built the Mishkan. And Hashem now has permanently established the Shekhinah dwelling among them. That is how Shemos ends, with the cloud descending on the Mishkan. And the Ramban is going to have an idea. He's telegraphing it now. He develops it later at length in Sefer Shemos, that the whole idea of a Mishkan is catching the lightning of Har Sinai in a bottle. That one moment in history where Hashem revealed himself with thunder and lightning and fire on a mountaintop in the middle of the desert, middle of nowhere, what the Mishkan is going to be all about is transferring that revelation to a stable, permanent establishment of the Shekhinah in the middle of all of Klal Yisrael. Ve'asuli mikdash ve'shachanti besocham, I will permanently dwell among you. So Ramban says, when they accomplish that, when the Shekhinah dwells permanently among them, Az Shavu el ma'alot avotam. Now they have returned to the level of their forefathers. Now they have gotten back to the level of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. And then the Ramban mixes in some of the Kabbalah, the idea that the faces of the Avos are established on the heavenly throne itself, on the Merkava itself, the extremely close relationship between the Avos and Ribono Shel Olam, the Medrash about the cloud of the Shekhinah, which dwelt above the tent of Sarah Imenu. And then when Yitzchak brings Rivka back into the tent, the cloud comes back. That was the world of the Avos and the Imahos, that intimate relationship that they established with the Kadosh Baruch Hu. When that has been returned, when that has been restored, Az Nechshavu Geulim, that is when you're considered redeemed. It's not just when you left slavery. And it's not even when you have that moment where the people are able to hear Hashem himself from the top of the mountain. It's when you have that relationship in place, the Shekhinah dwelling among the people. That's the end of Shemos. Is why do we have that cliffhanger? Why do we emphasize the Shekhinah was in the tent and even Moshe couldn't go in there? It reads like a cliffhanger. Ramban explains, on the one level, yes, it is a cliffhanger. On the other hand, it is the perfect time to end the book, because we're emphasizing the Shekhinah is here and it is such a powerful presence among us that even Moshe, remember, was able to enter the cloud on Har Sinai. Even Moshe Rabbeinu initially is not able to enter the Mishkan. Hashem's presence in the Mishkan is more powerful than his presence on Har Sinai. That is the moment of true Geula. True redemption means Hashem has returned to Bnei Yisrael, and that is the book of Shemot. So it's only a few psukim, but it's amazing how many massive themes the Ramban can pack into a few psukim. What is Sefer Bereishis all about? the idea of Maisa Avos, Simin Labanim, and the spiritual DNA of Bnei Yisrael, the unifying theme of Sefer Shemos, exile and redemption, what the meaning of redemption is, what the purpose of the Mishkan is. The Ramban has all that, and none of those ideas would you have ever had unless you had someone asking the 50,000-foot questions. The assumption that there is a larger Sefer over here, and I need to understand what the message of that Sefer is. And then the Ramban, he has his introduction to Vayikra, where you can say, okay, now that we have a book, now we have a Mishkan, we have Hashem among us. So Vayikra is all about how to keep the Shekhinah there, right? How to keep this Mishkan, the Karbanos, to keep that relationship with Bnei Yisrael, the observance of Tumah V'Tahara and the mitzvahs of Kedoshim. How can we be a holy people? Want to have Hashem among you? Well, you need to be a holy people. Well, guess what? We have Parashas Kedoshim telling us how to be a holy people. You follow the mitzvahs of Vayikra, and you can keep what you gained in Sefer Shemot. So those are just some examples of big picture thinking of the Ramban. Okay. So let's look at a few other examples. Here, take a look at this one. It's just a great example of how, on the one hand, the Ramban can be such a sweeping thinker, we also can get such sensitivity to detail. Torah tells us at the beginning of the second paragraph of Shmos, Vayilech ish mibeis Levi, vayikach es bas Levi. There was a man from the house of Levi, and he married a daughter from Levi. We know that this is Amram and Yocheved, and the child who's about to be born is going to be Moshe. So the question that you have to ask is, there's a word here which just doesn't seem to fit. Why does Torah tell us that a man went? Vayelech ish mibeis Levi. Torah, I mean, the Torah, every single word is used extremely carefully. Well, Torah could have just said, Vayikach ish mibeis Levi, isha mibas Levi. What's going on over here? So Rashi, so the Ramban quotes Rashi, who says that he went after his daughter's advice, Miriam persuading Amram to remarry Yocheved. The Ramban has a different approach, and this gives an insight into what's going on over there. It says Al Tati, why is it called Vayilech? Bavur Shelo Chashash L'Gzeirat Paro, because Amram and Yocheved had the courage. They ignored the decree of Paro, who had just decreed that the baby boy is going to be thrown into the Nile River. Despite the decree, he marries a woman to have children. Amar Akasuv Kain. And he says, Vayelech means it's a language of zealotry, right? Energy. They're not just getting married. They are going, they're swimming against the tide. They're taking a stance. It's a moral stance with this marriage. And how does the Ramban prove it? He says, let me just off the top of my head quote for you. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 psukim, where the language of vayelech is used to imply that there is a particular energy going on already. Is someone doing something which would not have happened naturally. Sometimes that can be something good. Sometimes that can be something bad. So as an example of vayelech Reuven, vayishkav as Bilha, Reuven went and slept with Bilha, with the wife of Yaakov. Now, that's he's definitely swimming upstream over there, right? That takes significant energy and guts to do in a bad way. Other examples as well. So that one word tips off the Ramban. We should be thinking the beginning of Sefer Shmos, right? That Moshe Rabbeinu never would have been born had it not been for the courage of his parents. Had it not been for that vayela, had it not been for that stance that they took, that energy, that courage, that we're going to do this despite the decree, so Moshe Rabbeinu never would have been born. The way Rashi's reading the pasuk, we're celebrating Miriam. The way the Ramban is reading the pasuk, we're celebrating Amram and Yocheved. And it's not so hard for us to have both of them, but that's just a message coming from one word in the pasuk. That very, very careful attention to detail. Okay. Rabbi has more, but let's just move on. Sorry. So the Ramban let's for now skip this also. We'll try to squeeze it a couple. Take a look. We want to talk about reconstructing psychology. So I really want to emphasize that. There are two amazing examples in Sefer Shemot. One, describing the enslavement of Bnei Yisrael, the process of how that slavery happened. And a second one, describing the response of Bnei Yisrael. One of the things that's amazing about the Ramban is that not only does he get us into the shoes to understand the behavior of the heroes of the Chumash, not only will he, for example, in Pasuk after Pasuk, show the growth of Avraham Avinu as he deals with challenge after challenge. And the Ramban shows you, you are not dealing with the same Avraham at the beginning of Lech Lecha that you're dealing with at the beginning of Chayei Sarah. He can reconstruct for us the heroes of the Chumash. The Ramban also is able to reconstruct the villains of the Chumash. There's what to learn from the bad guys too. And if they're just cartoonish people, there's nothing to learn. The Ramban reconstructs Paro, a number of instances where the Ramban reconstructs Paro, and probably the most powerful one, and one about his society as well, is when he describes the process of the enslavement. And the question is a basic one. Again, there's nothing here where there's no pasuk, which is hard to understand. The words themselves, we know. We know what happens. Paro says that there are too many Jews. They are dangerous. We need to outsmart them. They enslave them. They make them do work. Then he gets the midwives to try to kill the babies. Then Paro says to throw the babies into the Nile River. We know the words of the first chapter of Shmos. We know the story pretty well. The Ramban now can come in and ask the bigger questions. Right? The bigger questions to ask are, why does Paro do this? Often the Ramban will ask about something which is not in the text. So for example, the Ramban in Brachos asks, did Yaakov know whether or not Yosef was sold? There's no pasuk telling us one or the other, but if you're trying to recreate the story, you want it to be in Yaakov Avinu's head, you want it to be in the Shvatim's head, well, the end of Brachos is a huge difference if Yaakov knew what happened to him. Well, here also the Ramban asks about something which isn't there. He says, wait a second. If Paro's whole goal was to eliminate Bnei Yisrael, why not just kill them? So Ramban says, Lo ra'a Paro v'chachmei yo'atzav la'akosam b'char. Paro and his advisors did not think that they would just commit genocide. Now, why not? Ramban is going to give a few reasons why, and especially for us in a generation living after the Shoah, what he's about to say is particularly haunting. And I think gives us a particular understanding of why we have a mitzvah every year to remember and to wipe out a Amalek. Because we'll see what the difference is between the most evil, corrupt, oppressive society that the Torah focuses on, the world of Egypt, the country which we're told do not do like Egypt does, the place which we're told three times you can never move back to Egypt. As bad as Egypt is, let's see what's worse. Let's see what a Amalek is about. One step beyond Egypt. Ramban says the reason why Paro and his advisors couldn't just commit genocide, ki tia begida gidola lakot ha'am chinam. It would have been too great a betrayal to just slay a nation, asher bo be'eretz mitzvas ha'melech harisha. That was going too far. We're going to have tricks and machinations and activities to limit the threat. But even Paro thought that it was beyond the pale to just declare an open genocide the way that Haman is going to do it in Megillah Esther. What Amalek will have no problem doing in the Megillah, even Paro thinks that's going too far. That's an amazing line. The Torah says he forgot everything that Yosef did, but there's a step which is too far for Paro. And then the Ramban has another line. It says, V'gam ama aretz lo yitnu rishos lamelech lasos chamas kazeh. The Egyptian people would not go along with a plan like that. He has to take their advice into consideration. And he says, it's also a military threat. So Ramban says there are three reasons. It's too morally too repugnant for Paro. It's too repugnant for the Mitzrim. And Paro is a god, but yet Paro still has to answer to his people. That's going to be important, by the way, because later on, the Ramban is going to show that the people also bear responsibility for what happens. It's not just Paro's decisions, it's the decisions of the people as well. But the Ramban is saying such a step would have been too far for the people. And he also says, reason three, it would have been militarily too dangerous. Now, the Ramban could have just said the last one. He could have said they didn't commit genocide because it would have been too risky. But the Ramban is convinced that even Mitzrayim was not as bad as that. The people who in a few seconds were going to be throwing babies in the river, they were not as bad as committing genocide. We have that message. And that gives us a view of Egypt. It's a society that thinks of itself as sophisticated and advanced and moral. Egypt thinks of itself as the world's most advanced society. Our whole experience of Yetzias Mitzrayim and the whole world of relationship between Moshe and Paro is different when we realize these were not cartoon villains. Amalek are the cartoon villains. Haman is the cartoon villain. He's not a cartoon either. But that's ultimate evil. The evil of Egypt is a little bit more sophisticated. Dafka, the fact that these people still have some basic moral impulse left, in a way really makes all their behavior even worse. The fact that this is a society which is not beyond repair. Halacha is a descendant of Mitzrayim, is allowed to remarry into Bnei Yisrael after three generations. And the Torah says the reason why is because they allowed you into their land. There is some redeeming peace for this civilization, and that's just going to make all the behavior of the next few chapters worse and worse and worse. And the Ramban then goes on to show how that we can reconstruct what Paro does. So first, there's the decree of the enslavement, which begins as just a labor requirement, which is not unheard of. In fact, Shlomo HaMelech makes the people dedicate labor to the king. Before the IRS, nowadays, we give 25, 33, 40, 50% of our income to the government. Back then, you gave a percentage of your labor to the government. That is initially what Paro has Bnei Yisrael do. That's not unheard of. Then the next step, the Ramban says, is there was a secret conspiracy, get the midwives involved to quietly kill the babies without anybody knowing. And then when that doesn't work, they ramp it up, and the Ramban explains the decree of throwing the babies into the river. Well, it was never an explicit decree from the king that was made known. He says, for example, had that been the case, then it would have been the Egyptian soldiers who were going to go into every house and find every baby boy. The Ramban explains that what happened was the rumors were strategically deployed that people in Egypt should know that the government would look the other way if they threw the Jewish boys into the river. And the Ramban explains this tells us why that decree ends so quickly. Jews between the ages of 20 and 60 in the desert, but being as Moshe Rabbeinu himself was 80 at Yetzias Mitzrayim, that means that all of Bnei Yisrael were born after Moshe. It's clear that the decree against the babies ended quickly. The Ramban says, you know why? I'll tell you why. Very, very simple. The reason why that decree ended was because it got too far. The rumors were getting too strong. Paro was getting too implicated in the plot, and that is why Paro had to call it off. Looking at the enslavement of itself from that perspective. Now, just look at one more. Just look at the response of Bnei Yisrael. See what their suffering is. So Torah tells us that there's a new king, right? New king of Egypt, and Bnei Yisrael groan from the labor. The king dies, and the people groan. Rashi is a comment that the king didn't die. He actually only got saras. Reason why Rashi is saying that is because it doesn't make any sense for the king to die and the people to groan. When the king dies, when Paro dies, Bnei Yisrael should have had a party. So Rashi has to take saras. Saras is equivalent to death. He's killing more babies, and that's what people are growing. But the Ramban looks at it from a psychological perspective, and he has a profound, profound insight, and this gets us into the headspace of Bnei Yisrael. This is Alter Chapshat. Minhag ha-ne'evadim le-malach b'liyal rush. What would be the normal way to behave? If we were there, if we were slaves in Egypt, we're supposed to think of ourselves that way every year for the Haggadah. Well, what would we think? Shehayu mitzapim u'michakim liyom moto. They would be waiting every single day for that Paro to die. And we can imagine the rumors are coming out of the palace. Paro is old. Paro is sick. Paro is very sick. Every single day for years, the Jews are waiting for this paro who forgot Yosef to finally die. We'll have a new paro come in. New policy, new administration, new hope for us. They're placing their hope in a new paro administration. And then what happens? Imagine the devastation. Imagine the impact on their morale. When they saw the king died, they groaned terribly. Because the new king, who we've been waiting for decades, is worse than the old king. And then they groaned. And then he amru avdasik from Sinan Yigzarnulanu. We've lost all hope. They choose death over life. That's why they just cry out. When do Bnei Yisrael get desperate? For years, they have been placing their hopes in politics. Understandably so. They've been waiting. This paro is a one-off. We are hoping he's going to die and the new paro is going to be our salvation. And then we just have to imagine how crushed they are when after those decades of waiting and waiting and waiting, the new paro comes in and the one who's new is worse than the one who's old. That is the point when they give up all hope. And that is the point of that's the point where they just cry out to the Baruch Hu. That is the point of desperation. And that is the point where Hashem jumps in and take action. So those are just a few examples of how the Ramban can look from so far out and yet can zoom in so far. And the psychological insight he can give us such a profound understanding of what all of the people involved in the servant of Yisrael are doing. That is true for the Chumash as a whole. But I see my time is up, so we'll stop here. Thanks, everybody, for coming. And hope you enjoy the rest of the Archei Kala.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi Goldstein.
Thank you, everybody.